This is Dr. What? Dr. Where? Stories of Rural Medicine. It's the podcast exploring what it's like to live, work, and train in rural medicine across regional Victoria. This series, we're looking at ways you can take your professional practice to a new level, no matter where your career is at. Even if it's yet to begin, we'll be bringing you valuable insights from a whole range of voices in regional medicine. And what better way to get across how to navigate your training than hearing what trainees did to build a path towards a college training program? Every specialist pathway is different, and in this episode, you'll hear from doctors working regionally about how they successfully achieved entry to college training programs of their choice and how they knew this was a specialty for them. These speakers were recorded at a careers night organised by members of the Bendigo Health HMO Society and supported by the Northwest Victorian Regional Training Hub, Monash Rural Health. And while there's lots of handy, universal career advice, you can skip to the specialty you're looking for with the time codes in the show notes. It's also a two-parter episode, so check out part one to hear more trainees on specialist pathways if this episode hasn't got the specialty you're looking for. Starting off in this episode is Dr. Olivia Denham, a psychiatry registrar.
Hi everyone, I recognise some of you from a lecture earlier this semester. I'm Olivia, very much based in Bendigo. I'm actually a PGY7 as well, same as Jess. We were here for a year or so together. Maybe I'll start off with the time frame, but I'll make it brief. I finished school in like 07, high school. I'm from Bendigo originally. I went through Melbourne postgrad, so I did like a science, Bachelor of Science degree through Melbourne, and then the MD through Melbourne as well. I was rural. A lot of my rotations in medical school were in Bendigo and Shepparton, which is where I met my husband, who was also a med student at the time. And then I internshipped here, and that was back in 2016. I remember the years. During med school and in internship, I thought I wanted to do general practice, rehab medicine, or O&G. I can't believe that now. Like, there's no, it's not me at all. No offense. In internship, I did only subacute elective, so rehab and Jerry's here in Bendigo. Bendigo was fantastic for internship, so whoever is here, good job. Got lots of experience, especially in ED, actually. I was, really impressed with that. So, did lots of subacute in internship. By that stage, thought I wanted to do GP, went back to Melbourne because my husband was there, did a general year. And I was actually put into a psychiatry rotation at that stage, which I was not happy about. I thought I was getting peds and they put me in psych. But within a week, I couldn't believe how much I loved the rotation. And that was despite my reg, who was unaccredited, quit. My co-resident just wouldn't show up to work most of the time. So it was just myself and the psychiatrist on a very busy inpatient ward. This is at the Northern as well, so yeah, and I still loved it. Like, it was great. We had people escaping and like really unwell patients, and it was just so much fun. And I was like, I want to do this. So did the rest of my general year, which I'd highly recommend if you have any interest, or even if you don't have an interest in psychiatry, which I didn't, because looking back, medical rotations in particular are really important post internship too. So completed my general year, but during PGY2 applied for the program and got on and started in PGY3 back in Bendigo. That was in 2018. It's a 5-year training program. That's if you get through it full time, which this was prior to the pandemic, but I think less than 20% of trainees get through the 5-year training program in those 5 years. It's actually pretty intense in terms of what you've got to do. It's getting more challenging to get onto the program itself. So back in the day, you could get on after internship with any psych experience. That's now not the case. Regionally, it's even changed more so. So you could get on with just one rotation of psychiatry under your belt as an intern or, say, PGY2. However, now often they want you to have done a full unaccredited year within psych. It's really getting competitive. In terms of applying, so you need three, and sorry, this is again testing my memory like Jess, three references, one of which has to be a psychiatrist. You have to write a CV. There's I think it's either 200 or 400 word statement on why you want to be a psychiatrist in the future. And then you apply to both the college as well as all the hospitals that you would be interested in training at, training hubs, I should say. And so you have the college interview as well as all of the hospitals that you've applied for if they offer you an interview there as well. And then after those interviews, you rank where you'd like to go, and the college does that as well. You have to pass the college interview in order to get a spot. I have heard of trainees not passing that, and then even though they might have done well in the hospital interviews, they aren't on the programs, and then they've got to try again the following year. From memory, so the college interview, there's a panel of three people, and they really don't give you, they ask certain questions, and they're mainly certain clinical situations with like medico-legal, I don't know, cultural, all kinds of like extra challenges included, and they really give you nothing back. It was like talking to a wall, which can be a little bit, it's strange. So I'd recommend practicing as much as possible for, the interview if you're interested in psych. I've chose to do my training in Bendigo. This is home for me. My husband and I are here. We have a child and a house and a dog. With regards to training itself, there's a bit of a bottleneck with certain rotations. So during training, you have to do child and adolescent and consultation liaison psychiatry. And in the city hospitals, there's actually not enough spots for those mandatory rotations that you have to do before you get into advanced training, which is year 4 and 5. Bendigo is great in terms of the number of trainees they allow in each year. So far, touch wood, we haven't had a bottleneck. There's always availability for you to get through those two mandatory rotations, ideally in your second year of training, which is great because it really is an issue in the metro settings. And if you say perhaps wanted to move elsewhere, you're much more employable once you've done the CL rotation and the CAMS rotation. Sorry, CL and child and adolescent. I love psychiatry for so many reasons. There's so much variety. Every presentation is different in terms of the patients who you get to see, and all of their stories are so unique. I feel very privileged a lot of the time in terms of what people share with you as well, because you've got to ask about some pretty sensitive topics too, and it's amazing what people will open up to you. I guess the flip side of that is, especially within the public setting, you're often caring for patients who don't want to be there and they're under the Mental Health Act, and especially when perhaps they're really unwell. Yeah, it's an interesting dynamic in terms of dealing with those patients, so that can be a bit challenging at times. I very much plan on staying in Bendigo within a regional setting. So within Bendigo itself, you can't subspecialise in all of the subspecialities. So for example, like forensics, we don't have a forensics rotation here. However, saying that, Bendigo is really good at finding certain rotations if you have an interest back in Melbourne to go and do. But yeah, we at this stage, you can subspecialise in, so you can do general psychiatry. We should get the adult certificate on board, hopefully. Child and adolescent, older persons, and hopefully CL comes back as well. Oh, the other thing I did as well, so once I got into training, I started training back in 2018 on the program, and I've taken a few breaks since then. So one was to travel and locum. I can't speak for other training programs, but psych, they're very supportive of you doing other things within training. So I literally took a break to locum and they were fine with that. You just kind of have to state your case to the college and then they approve it. And that was fantastic. I got so much experience locuming interstate, and I was paid even more highly because I was an accredited registrar as well. So it was a higher rate than unaccredited positions. I went over to WA and New South Wales for a lot of 1 year, and then actually got sick of travelling, so came back to Bendigo and locumed here because I just wanted to be at home for a bit, which was great too. I've since taken another break to have a baby, and I'm back part-time. The college itself is very supportive of part-time training. You can't do the first year part-time. That has to be full-time. But then after that, it depends on the hospital itself. There's a bit of negotiation involved there. But the college itself is supportive of part-time training. And you can take up to 13 years to get through the five-year training program. And I think take up to 5 years of a break. But I think you have to really state your case for longer than a year at a time off.
There is a question about how do you balance doing your master's while working?
Oh, I forgot about the master's. Jeez. Yeah. with the master's. So, frustratingly, in Victoria at this stage, it might have changed. Correct me if I'm wrong. If you get onto the program in Victoria, Masters of Psychiatry is mandatory. If you train in any other state or territory, you don't have to do the Masters of Psychiatry, which is a little gripe of mine, but anyway. Saying that, though, I have learned a lot from the Masters, so that's a positive. It's designed to be done alongside work, and it takes 3 years to get done. If you're interested in psychiatry, and as in, like, you're sure you want to pursue this specialty, then I'd actually recommend starting the master's ahead of time. That first year of training in particular is intense. Yeah, in terms of full-time work, all of the work-based assessments, your master's on call, and then you've also got college exams to think about too. If you can start the master's and just get used to having to study again regularly, then that would be a good idea. If not, then that's okay. Just start it when you start specialty training. The good news with the master's is you can take breaks from it as well. At this stage, so I've done mine through Melbourne Uni, Monash offers it as well, and some other uni I can't think of too. During training, you have to do the master's, and then in terms of exams, there's a multiple choice exam that has to be done before you go into advanced training, so that's fourth and fifth year. And then there's two other written exams that have to be done at some stage during training. There's an OSCE, but that's under review at the moment, so there's an alternative assessment pathway, which I won't go into because it'll go back to an OSCE, I'd say, at some stage. And then you've got to do a research project as well. It doesn't have to be published, but that's something to think about. You can get prior recognition for that. So if you did something mental health related in med school or, you know, as an intern or whatever, they might approve that as your scholarly project, which would be great. And you also have to do a psychotherapy case, which involves following up a patient for 40 sessions and then writing a 10,000 word case report. And often you don't submit that for quite a few years because it's got to be at a psychiatrist level. So you get other psychiatrists to critically appraise it, provide you with feedback. You usually then rewrite it and then submit it. I haven't submitted mine yet. I'm still writing it for the first time because I'm going to blame it on my baby in terms of taking a while to write that up. So yeah, I think people, that's probably the one thing that I didn't talk about before, is that people don't realise just how much study is involved once you're on and how many, like, exams and hurdle requirements there are once you're actually on the program. But I think it's worth it. Like, the end result will be great.
Next up is Dr. Olivia Denham, an unaccredited general surgery registrar. She reflects on some of the advice Dr. Laura McDonald gave in part one, while also discussing the General Surgeons Australia pathway she's on.
So, oh yeah, I'm Danielle. I'm going to talk about Gen Surge, but I can sort of maybe talk about some of the other specialties, not ortho, if anyone has any questions. I'm not going to ask who wants to do Gen Surge because you all want to do Gen Surge. So, a lot of the stuff I'm going to say will be pretty similar to the things that everyone else has already said, so I'll be brief and pretty similar to Laura as well. But the main thing I think everyone needs to take out about this whole session is that there are so many different ways to do all these different things. So it doesn't have to be prescriptive what we're saying. Just do what works for you, what you enjoy. And if you're enjoying work, then things will fall into place. So I am currently PGY5 and I'm an unaccredited reg this year, which, just to recap in case anyone's a bit confused, every time we say unaccredited, it just means that we're not on the program yet. But I will be starting Gen Surge training next year. So I was a Melbourne Uni student. I did the Rural Clinical School. I was mostly Ballarat, a little bit of time here. And then I came and did my internship here in Bendigo. I had a fantastic year. So again, anyone else that's staying here, you're going to have a great year. But the main reason why I went to the city was to do the same thing as Laura. So I did the anatomy diploma in PGY2. And I also did my GCSE then as well. And I echo what she said. If you're doing any surgical specialty, do your GCSE early before you forget all of that stuff from med school that you've learnt so well, because it's really hard going back and being all like, you know, respiratory physiology and learning about neutrophil nets and whatever. Like, do it early before you forget it. So I did that in PGY2 and just did a surgical year. And I knew I wanted gen surg, but I took the opportunity to do different surgical specialties because it's useful, you know, especially when you come back to the country. You know, here in Bendigo, we don't have ENT. Gen surg often covers urology. Like, it's good to have all those other skills in different areas to bring into your general job. So again, if you're going to do gen med, the same thing applies. It's good to get all that experience in your other subspecialties to bring it into your role when you're a reg later on. So I spent PGY 2, 3, 4 at Western, which if anyone is going to Western, that was also a really great place. They were, you know, had similar attitudes to a regional hospital, and I had a lot of opportunity to get research projects done. Different specialties require a different amount of research. Gen surg requires a lot of research. It's all pretty clearly laid out for gen surg and the other surgical specialties when you look it up on the internet, what the CV involves and what you get points for. But you really, to get onto gen surg, you really need to have probably 2 first author papers. You may chuck in a little case report or something there as well, and a couple of poster or oral presentations. Now, this is not necessarily something you need to all get stuck into next year when you're interns. I encourage you all to have an enjoyable internship, you know, enjoy the job, make heaps of friends, but would definitely suggest you sort of start making some tracks on that PGY 2 or 3, because it takes time to get these things done. You know, case reports can only take you a short period of time, but to get these biggest projects done, you don't want to have to try and rush through them. You want to spend a couple of years getting them done. So as you're going through it, you know, chat to your registrars, chat to the residents the year above you, see what they're up to and get advice from them as well. There are some other things, so similar to Laura, all this like surgical specialties that go through RACS have the similar courses that she already mentioned. So there's like ACET and EMST. And so yeah, so I did my anatomy diploma as well in PGY2, did my GCSE, a couple of research projects. And I also, gen surg gives points for teaching. We don't give any points for volunteering or sports or leadership or, you know, clubs or HMO societies, but you get points for teaching. So I contacted Melbourne Uni and just did some shoots every week for them, which was, again, it's pretty enjoyable. You guys will know about now, you're towards the end of your med school. When you have those times on the ward and you're teaching the third years or the second years at Melbourne, it is pretty good, you know, being able to part some of that wisdom onto them. So I'd recommend, if you're interested in teaching, to contact the uni, probably not an internship because, again, just enjoy your year, but down the track and get involved in doing some teaching there as well. I then decided to come back to Bendigo this year, which I think in the eyes a lot of the people that I had worked with in the city, everyone thought it was a very unusual decision to sort of to change hospitals or come back to a regional centre. But I've obviously had a fantastic year. I love Bendigo as an intern here, so I've come back here to be a reg. And similar, well, I mean, really what everyone else has been echoing, having that regional experience, you get more hands-on, you get to know your bosses better. It's a great, you know, work environment. So I would definitely recommend spending some time back regionally if you get that opportunity. And so yeah, I applied this year and I managed to get on for next year. What you need to do to apply, I've written down some of the things because I'd forgotten even though it was this year. The first thing is you need to do a hand hygiene module, which every year someone does the wrong hand hygiene module and does not get onto the program after paying, you know, a couple thousand dollars. Your GCSE, just, yeah, you have to study the anatomy, physiology, you've got to know the pathology, you just sort of try your hardest, cross your fingers and hope nothing weird comes up. You get obviously points for your experience, so you've had to work a couple of years getting any surgery jobs. You get points for, and then the CV. So this applies for all of the surgical specialties. It's all nicely clearly written on the internet. So if you look up, literally you type in RACS, I want to be a surgeon, and it comes up with like, what specialty do you want to do? And it takes you to their website. And, you know, I think being surgery, it's all nice and like, you get points for this, similar to ONG. But, you know, you can always look at that, see vaguely what it involves, don't get too hung up on it when you're an intern or PGY2, because it will almost definitely change by the time you're applying. They're constantly tweaking it as well. But nothing, you know, they're not going to add a whole new category of something that you haven't thought of, but they'll continually tweak it as well. And then, of course, you have your references as well, but I won't go over that because I think everyone else has sort of covered that pretty clearly. With the CV, I think someone asked before about like masters. So I think that you have to think about what you want to get out of it. So there's a lot of different masters of surgery that you can do. You can do a coursework masters of surgery. You can do research ones. You can do some that are face-to-face and some that you do completely online. So you have to just think, am I doing this to just get points for my CV? Which some people do. It's a very expensive point. You know, you're paying $50,000 to get 2 points for a master's with some unis, or you could come rural for 1 year and get 3 points. So that's kind of how I think about it. If you're doing a research master's, like, you know, that's always going to be useful, but they take a bit more time, so they're not going to be necessarily useful for your CV. I decided that I did not want to spend $50,000 for 2 points for my application, but I have a lot of friends that have done them, and they've done the ones that are, there's some in Edinburgh that are online. There's a Masters of Traumatology, which is, again, they're kind of often things for points, but you just have to, you know, weigh it up. I did the anatomy diploma, which wasn't as expensive as when Laura did it, but it is quite expensive. But you do put it on your HEX and then you claim it back on tax as well, even though you haven't technically paid for it yet. So there's like, it's actually okay. You just chuck it on your HEX and forget about it. The other things that I was going to go through is, so yeah, mostly along the way, like again, for all the specialties, always just talk to the people that are one or two steps ahead of you, see what they did, see what advice they have about how they're doing it. A lot of my advice I got on to get to Gen Surge early on were from like urology registrars, because a lot of it's pretty similar. And similar to what Laura was saying, just be around, be keen, similar to what Jess said, tell people that you want to do that specialty so that they keep an eye on you and they make sure that they're, you know, helping you with your applications, your interviews. You just need to practice. So you all probably did practice for your internship interviews, but when you get closer to your specialty ones, you've got to do like a lot of practice and speak to the people that are, again, a step ahead of you, because there's all these funny little niche things that the specialties will want you to do and say to tick those boxes. Otherwise, yeah, my other bits of advice would be for all surgery, go to theatre. Often you might think you like the specialty and then you go to theatre and you're like, I never want to hear a drill or a hammer again. So, you know, don't do that specialty, or you think brains are gross, don't do neurosurgery. So go to theatre, go to conferences. Even if you're not going there to, you know, present your presentation or do a poster, I think they're great. They're, you know, trips away with work, you claim them on tax and you learn stuff and you meet people and have a few drinks and be social. Do research, as I said, start that maybe PGY 2 or 3. If small things pop up in internship, great, but don't flog yourself. You're supposed to have an enjoyable year. The other things are, I say, make sure you're looking after yourself. I know everyone says it all the time, but it is very important. If you're doing internship here in Bendigo, make sure you've got a nice GP like Ash. She's still here. Because, you know, you'll need that. And even if you're moving around, make sure there's someone around that you can talk to. Internship's a great year. You'll have your cohort. I mean, I did internship with Ash. We're still friends. So that's good. And, just be keen. Put your hand up for opportunities and everything will fall into place. Everyone want to do Gen Surge now? Yeah. Oh, yeah, I love Gen Surge because it's great and you get to see all kinds of crazy things.
Yeah. All right. So hello, everyone. I'm Tom. I'm an ICU registrar working here in Bendigo. I'm talking tonight about ICU training and how it relates here to Bendigo. So ICU training is overseen by the College of Intensive Care Medicine, which is a fairly new college, only came into existence in 2008. It was previously part of the College of Physicians and Anesthetics, but now it's a standalone college. To do ICU training, it's about 6 years, which 3.5 of that is being in ICU and the other 2.5 is a mix of external rotations. I'll try and summarise like the progression of ICU training, but it's quite similar to ED in that there's two sets of exams, the first set being your primary exams and the final ones being a fellowship. To be eligible to apply to ICU, you need to have done 6 months of ICU training, or sorry, not training, experience anywhere, so generally as a HMO. And after that, you're eligible to apply. So theoretically, you could do it if you got a lot of ICU and PGY2, but most people would at the very earliest be PGY3 after they've done 2 3-month rotations. You'll then apply to the college, and then after you're accepted, then you're officially a trainee. A bit of a downside of ICU training is the only ICU time you can start accrediting is post-primary. So as soon as you get on, none of the time you start working in ICU as a registrar will count until you do your primary exam. So after you've passed your primary, though, you have to do 24 months of what's called core ICU training, and you have to do 12 months of at least in a centre that has cardiac surgery, neurosurgery and trauma. So for example, if you work at the Alfred, if you do 12 months there, that satisfies all those, but none of those things are often Bendigo, so they don't count, but you still do count some of your time. So once you've done your 24 months of your core ICU time, as well as a whole list of external or non-ICU rotations, then you're eligible to sit the fellowship exam, and then you go into the transition year, which is essentially like a college enforced fellowship year where you're acting as a consultant. The external rotations that are important to know about are anaesthetics. You have to do 12 months of that, which is notoriously very hard to come by. You have to do 6 months in acute medicine, which can be ED, retrieval, or being an admitting med reg. Obviously no one does admitting med reg because it's awful. And internal medicine is like longitudinal medicine, which could be being a ward med reg or PAL care, cardiology, anything like that. You have to do an elective, which is literally anything. You also have to satisfy rural exposure, something like Bendigo, and PEDS time, which is a bit more complicated. But you can either work in a PICU, work somewhere that admits a certain number of PEDS cases. So I'm hoping to do somewhere like Geelong or Darwin, who admit in a mixed ICU. So once you've done all of your external rotations and your core time, then you can sit your fellowship exam. It's important to know, though, that all of the non-ICU time doesn't depend on when you've done the exams or not. So if you're still waiting to do your primary exam, any ED, anaesthetics or elective time counts. So that's a good time to get it out of the way. The exams themselves are notoriously, much like ED and anaesthetics, quite challenging. I just did my first part exam, primary exams, and I was probably studying for between 9 and 12 months. So it's quite an undertaking, but it's one you really want to do. Otherwise, you don't have the chance to credit your ICU time. So the way that I got here, I did postgrad med, but I did my undergrad at Melbourne Uni and then did postgrad med at Deakin. And I guess probably the reason I'm here is because I did my last 2 years at Warrnambool, which is smaller than Bendigo, but it gave me that real flavour for regional medicine, which I think we all probably can understand the pros of. I then went back to Melbourne, did intern year and resident year at the Austin, where I did my first 3 months of ICU. I thought it was all right. Didn't like absolutely love it. I was pretty sure I wanted to do anaesthetics then. So I came up here to do the quick care year, tried to get into anaesthetics, and then realised after I did more ICU that it's actually anaesthetics for the most part is quite boring. ICU for the most part is quite interesting. So I jumped ship and applied at the end of that year. Last year was my first year as a registrar, and I did it as an ICU reg employed, but I rotated to ED for 6 months to accredit that time. And then this year I sat my exam and also had a baby, not me personally, but my wife is here. I went part-time because I knew for the first half of the year I wanted to focus on the exam, for the second half I wanted to focus on the little one. And then for the future, I've got a 2-year contract here, so I'll be doing my medicine time, PAL care, then 12 months of anaesthetics, then another 6 months of ICU before we head off to do the next part of training. So why Bendigo? I think you'll probably all know a lot of these reasons, but it's a really uniquely excellent place to do ICU training. It gives you the really fundamentals. I mean, there's no open heart surgery, but we see the same stuff time and time again that you really see a lot of it wherever you are in ICU. So things like, you know, sepsis and other forms of shock that you get quite good at managing. And as often you're the only ICU registrar, particularly on night shifts, like you could be very junior training and have, you know, the exposure of the whole hospital. So I think that's quite a unique thing, whereas if you're in the city, then there's going to be many people above you who are going to get the chance to, you know, make that first assessment and do all the things that you have to do from there on in. We've got a really great group of consultants who are really nice to get along with and very grounded. They offer multi-year contracts. I think most recently, I think you can even get a 3-year contract now, but that gives you that certainty. And the guarantee of external rotation. So I was still quite junior, but being able to do 12 months of anaesthetics this early on is a huge advantage. And they're also quite flexible, given that I'm part-time, which is really helpful if you want to, you know, take some time off just to chill out or have a child or go travelling or do whatever. I can definitely advocate for part-time. I wasn't planning on it, but it's a really good thing to do if you feel like it's on offer to you. I won't go into the intricacies, but it didn't actually impact on my progression of training because I was still waiting to do my exam, so doing more ICU time before the exam wouldn't have counted for anything. And you can then, you know, look at other things outside of, you know, the hospital job itself. So, you know, I do some work here and in the sim lab, which I really like. You can also do some more locuming and other stuff. So it's a really flexible option. And when I kind of thought about doing ICU training, I made like a mock 6 year starting from internship where you go from internship to the HMO to do a quick care year and then 3 years as a registrar. And then by that time, you're only theoretically 2 years away from being ready for your fellowship exams in ICU. So it just goes to show that being somewhere like Bendigo is a great place for ICU training. But I guess the important thing to ask is why would you want to do ICU? The reasons I've written down here are quite long. It's acute and critical care medicine, doesn't really get much, you know, more sick than people in ICU. It sounds really nerdy. It's physiology in action. That sounded cooler when I wrote it, but you literally, you know, look at all the textbooks and all the equation stuff and you can manipulate them in a person in front of you. We get lots of interesting medical conditions. Some of the coolest stuff is in ICU. And you're a really vital member of the hospital team. Like, no offense to the anaesthetists, they're great and like in theatre, but that's about all they're great for. In all seriousness, like as a intensive care doctor, you're always going to the ward for met calls and code blues, going to ED to review patients. And one of the intensivists said to me the other day, something which slightly bit of a backhand compliment to ICU, but we're the second best at everything in the hospital, but not the best at anything. So you're very helpful. And it's nice to be part of the hospital. Yeah, you work, much like ED, work very close with the nursing staff and allied health, which is really nice. You do lots of procedures, particularly vascular access. So if you like sticking veins, so needles in big veins and arteries, that's good fun. And plenty of airway stuff. So if you still kind of like anaesthetics, then it's a good alternative. And it's quite flexible, as I mentioned before, in terms of its training. You really do see people at their toughest time in their life, and it's challenging, but it's probably the most rewarding parts of the job is managing that. And something I didn't write down, but just hearing the orthopedics and surgical talks, it's not that hard to get in. So you don't have to give a kidney or, do this exam that you might, pass and might get you in. If you just satisfy the requirements, which aren't that onerous, then it's quite straightforward to get in. The real bottleneck comes to the exams. So why not ICU? I mean, 6 years is a long training time. And that's bare minimum. Most people take several years longer than that just because of exams and unable to get external rotations. You do a lot of night shifts. They're long shifts. Most shifts are 12 and a half hours. And there's a lot of death and dying, so that can be a bit doom and gloom, but you get used to it after a while. And on that happy note, that's all I've got. So I'm happy to answer any questions if anyone has any.
Any recommendations for getting hard to come by crit care terms?
In terms of being like a HMO or just in general?
Rotation-wise in general.
I think coming somewhere like Bendigo is a good place for crit care HMO. I initially applied to stay at the Austin and didn't get that job, but it turned out to be the best thing that happened because we're very happy here. And probably the same thing applies for when you are a registrar, just rooting yourself into a city hospital and refusing to move. And coming somewhere like Bendigo, I think other places like Gippsland have a similar arrangement where there's lots more opportunities to get external rotations much earlier on in your training. That's probably my best advice.
All right, now we have lucky last is Diane Lim speaking on Rad Onc.
Hi everyone. It's late for you guys and sorry for keeping you guys around. I suppose different people have gone through, what you want to do. And I started in med school. I thought I wanted to do ophthalmology. Was all gung-ho and, spent lots of weekends putting my hand up, collecting data from this private ophthalmologist's rooms. And when they went out for research weekends, I put my hand up and volunteered time and did all of that. I am doing nothing like that whatsoever at this point in time. I finished med school back in 2011, which is ages ago. And it's taken me a while to get to where I am. This year at the moment, I'm an unaccredited radiation oncology registrar, and I've gotten onto the program and will be starting training next year. In fact, one of my juniors in med school, who's 1 year below me, is actually now a consultant in radiation oncology at Peter Mac. So that's how long I've taken to drag on. A lot of the people in this room can attest to having worked as interns under me when I was the unaccredited surg reg. Like I said, finished med school back in 2011. Thought I wanted to do ophthalmology, so I organized so that I had like plastics and ophthal as one of my rotations in internship. And then for, you know, my surgical term, I got gen surg. And then for my medical term, I made sure I got gastro so that, you know, I could get as much as of an interventional rotation as possible so I could get hands-on. And guess what? In internship, the consultant, even because I did mine internship in a regional hospital, I did it in Tassie in Launceston. Guess what? I did my first gastroscopy. The consultant walked me through it and did it with him holding my hand. So, you know, that's why I've chosen to stay regional since then. So did internship, and then PGY2, I did an acute medical term, did ICU for 3 months as a HMO, and then in the second half of PGY2, I jumped straight into an unaccredited surg reg job. I did unaccredited ENT regging. I was very, very scared. And the reason was because in that job, as an unaccredited registrar, there was no accredited registrar. I was it. It was me and then the boss. And I would get calls because at that stage, after hours, I was on call for urology, I was on call for ENT, I was on call for plastics. I did not know how to manage any of those cases. You know, I'd never seen testicular torsion ever, but I'd called the boss in and said, ED have referred a testicular torsion. I'm not quite sure what I'm seeing. So you don't have to know what you want to do at this stage in your career. I did lots of unaccredited regging all the way until 2017. And then I realized, hang on, it's not what I want to do, because by that stage I'd done unaccredited surg regging in gen surg, in plastics, in ENT, in urology, in vascular. I'd even spent time on neurosurg and realized it wasn't for me, because I remember the end of the first case, the consultant turns around to me after the end of a craniotomy, goes, wasn't that the best thing you've ever seen in your whole life? I was like, yeah, sure. So back in 2017, I knew that I didn't want to do surg regging, but I didn't know what I wanted to do with myself. But because I had all that experience under my belt, essentially between 2018 and really till the start of this year, I'd been doing locum work as a surg reg. I'd done locum work as an ED registrar as well. Just because I'd all that experience under my belt, it didn't really matter. It didn't faze me. I could cope with lots of things, being on the ward, being it, you know, in clinics, be it ED referrals for acutes, referrals from GPs over the phone, anything like that. I just took it all in my stride. And then one of the consultants, I don't know how many of you guys are actually based here in Bendigo at the moment, but Janelle Brennan, who's the Professor Janelle Brennan, Associate Prof, she's one of the urology bosses that I've worked under as well here in Bendigo. And she said to me, Di, what are you doing with yourself? You need to get yourself into a training program and stop wasting your life away. So she said, towards the end of last year, she said, we haven't filled our urology fellow job. Just apply for it. You'll get on. And you need to work out what you want to do. I applied for the job. I became the unaccredited urology reg here in Bendigo earlier this year. And with all my off time that I wasn't working, I actually put my hand up and I volunteered my time to do an observership with the radiation oncology team here in Bendigo, which is actually a satellite campus from Peter Mac in Melbourne. And so I realized that's what I really wanted to do. And so when an unaccredited job opening opened up in April this year, I applied and got the position, and I started the job in June. When I started the job in June, I was told, look, be prepared for radiation oncology. You need to do, people generally do between 12 and 18 months of unaccredited time before you're able to get onto the training program, just because you need to know what the job entails. And because of how different the specialty is compared to a lot of the other jobs in the hospital environment as well. When I applied for training, I miraculously got on, and the feedback that I got at the end of it was because of the breadth of knowledge that I'd brought on with me into the job that allowed me to get on the job. So for anyone who's thinking potentially of radiation oncology, it might not have ever crossed your mind before. Essentially, you know, the interviewers have since told me, saying that, look, they're looking for people who, if you've done surge regging, if you've done med regging, those are things that are looked favorably upon when you get on. But these days for radiation oncology, you pretty much, it's unheard of people getting onto the training program without any experience whatsoever with radiation oncology. What does it take to get on? You need to show that you have an interest in research, which I think everyone sort of pushed on and on about. RadOnc is very much research driven. A lot of the practice as well, it's, a lot of it is based on best practice and all evidence-based practice. And so you have to be interested. And in fact, part of the training program as well, you need to have published your research. It's actually one of the requirements to actually get through and finish training. With the training itself, there are exams, two parts to the exams. The first part exam, you can sit anywhere from the second year of training onwards. And then the final exit exams, you can sit from fourth year onwards. RadOnc training is a minimum of 5 years, of which if you pass your part two exams, the exit exams, if you finish and manage to pass them at the end of fourth year, for fifth year, you can take up and do a fellowship, be it nationally, like within Australia and New Zealand, or you can choose to do an international fellowship. As long as you get it approved by the college beforehand, you can get done and dusted with fellowship as well within the 5 years. Any questions?
I've got a question. How did you know you were interested in it?
I'd realised that I was really comfortable with RadOnc because having done all those different surgical specialties before, I'd become really comfortable in dealing with cancer patients, dealing with them at a stage where patients are actually feeling at a very, very vulnerable stage of their lives. And I found that I was able to use those skills that I'd gained over the years, again, with those patients that I had in front of me in radiation oncology. With radiation oncology, it's RANSCA is a college that's shared between RadOnc and radiology. It's the same college. But the training scheme is two separate training schemes, and the application is two separate applications. Having said that, you need to be good at reading all the imaging, because a lot of the treatment, in fact, not a lot, all of the treatment that we plan is imaging based. And so, you know, a lot of my daily work where I'm planning people's radiation therapy, I'm looking at their scans and planning their treatment based on their scans. And so the skills that I'd built up in the various surgical specialties has come in really handy for me in RadOnc, just because I'd been so used to looking at imaging from so many different body systems from the various specialties I'd done beforehand.
Thanks for listening. The Northwest Victoria and Gippsland Regional Training Hubs have commissioned this podcast to help medical students and junior doctors learn more about training and practicing medicine in regional Australia. There are hubs all across the country. To find out where your nearest regional training hub is, visit the link in the episode show notes or just search regional training hubs. Finally, this podcast was brought to you by Monash Rural Health, presented by Patrick Laverick, that's me, and it was made possible by funding from the Rural Health Multidisciplinary Training Program at the Commonwealth Department of Health.